I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A key figure who helped federal prosecutors convict former Philadelphia Congressman Shaka Fatah will avoid prison time. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
Tom Lindenfeld is a specialist in political field operations who worked on countless campaigns.
Tom was known as the guy who would get the job done.
David Dunphy's one of many political consultants who attended Lindenfeld's sentencing in federal court.
If you needed to make sure that voter turnout hit certain levels, Tom would get them there. He was known as a hard-charging political operative.
In Fatah's unsuccessful 2007 run for Philadelphia mayor, Lindenfeld didn't just do field work. He helped arrange for a secret, illegal $1 million loan to the campaign and played a role in repaying some $600,000 of it with stolen charitable and government funds. Prosecutors eventually got onto the scheme and confronted Lindenfeld. His father, Peter, says he always admired his political work, and he remembers when his son told him he'd done some bad things and would be helping the government.
And it was devastating to me, and it still is, because there's no limit to what he could have done.
Tom Lindenfeld pleaded guilty to a single count of wire fraud and told his story in court. Judge Harvey Bartle said his testimony was critical to the government's case. He sentenced him to 4 years probation and a $5,000 fine. Shaka Fatah was convicted on all counts against him and is awaiting sentencing. He resigned his congressional seat in June. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Several big healthcare providers and research organizations in New Jersey and New York have been monitoring the health of those directly affected by the 9/11 terrorist attacks. They track employees working in the towers, first responders, and those who cleaned up the site. 15 years on, they're seeing some alarming trends emerge, as WHYY's Mike and Scott reports.
In the wake of 9/11, researchers expected to see an increase in asthma and respiratory issues among those who were exposed to the rubble of the World Trade Center. They did see that, but now they're also seeing lots of patients with blood and throat cancers, which are unusual in the general population. Iris Udison heads the Clinical Center for World Trade Center Responses at Rutgers University. She says many of the 1,300 people receiving services at the center also suffer from anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress. She told one of her patients to avoid any coverage of the 15th anniversary.
I just told him that he's allowed to watch Disney movies, The Animal Planet, but I didn't want him watching all the live coverage of things.
She says with some patients who've also gotten cancer following 9/11, mental health problems have gotten worse.
And now that they're having some god-awful chemotherapy or radiation, that's bringing on their post-traumatic stress, or it's bringing it back to them.
Udison expects to see an uptick in cancers among her patients over the next 10 years. Researchers believe it's related to the cement dust containing harmful particles that people inhaled. I'm Mike and Scott, WHYY News.
It's no secret that many returning service members think that the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, or the VA, is failing them. Long wait times, a healthcare philosophy that some see as overly reliant on medication, a scourge of suicides. But some vets in the Philadelphia area are not letting that determine how they'll live once they come home from war, especially the ones who've served since 9/11. Projects for vets and created by vets are cropping up across our area to help fill in the gaps where support is otherwise falling short. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
Every Sunday, before many of us have had our first cup of coffee, local veterans are already gathering at CrossFit Inspire in Malvern. The reason? A grueling 25-minute workout free of charge for vets and their families. Retired Marine Marty Kenny started the group The Weekly Fight in late 2015, after a Marine he'd served with overseas committed suicide.
You know, once I got past all the would've, could've, and should've's, all I could think of is this is the kids' Christmas from now on. This is what they're going to think about every time this time of year comes by. And I was, I got to do something.
With The Weekly Fight, Kenny is hoping to create a safe space for vets struggling with combat PTSD and provide support from fellow service members.
When I bring these guys together and we get them here, and they get to sweat a little bit, they get a little pain, there's a little suffering, And there's a lot of jabbing back and forth about, you know, putting out max effort and everything else. It brings some of that community and that sense back to what they're missing. And I think that's the beauty of what we do.
The group also dedicates each workout to a vet who committed suicide. James O'Flaherty left the Marine Corps in 2015 after several combat deployments to Afghanistan. He says he's still affected by PTSD, but he's able to keep it under control, thanks in part to the weekly fight.
There are some little things that I'm working through, but the reason I say little is because I'm not going to let them be big. Because what we've got going on is bigger.
Is this part of how you manage it?
Yeah, without a doubt. No question about it. No question about it.
Mark Abbott also served in the Marine Corps. He says sweating through the workout reminds him of some of his more difficult days living with combat PTSD.
It's like, as silly as that sounds, it's only 25 minutes, but like, it's a really long time when your heart rate's at like 167 or 170 beats a minute and you're sucking wind. 20 minutes is forever. That grind, I want to get comfortable there. I want to push myself to the point where like, I'm dying inside. And just look up and smile, because I can, you know? Say, like, whatever it is, whatever that deep down, dark, nasty, scary thought is, just look at it and go, nothing.
The weekly fight is part of a growing trend of groups for vets and created by vets that aim to help fill in the gaps where support is lacking from institutions like the Department of Veterans Affairs or even well-meaning civilians. According to the VA, 20 United States veterans are committing suicide each day. Psychologist Wyndon Rowe says the VA often relies too heavily on medication when many vets simply want that feeling of usefulness they had in the military.
And the question always is, well, how do we support veterans? Like, how do we do this? How do we help them? Is it we give them money? Well, not necessarily. You give them purpose and task, right? Something to do and something that has meaning.
Rose says struggling vets often isolate themselves. Others, though, start thriving again once they found a community full of people who've lived through the same ordeal or when they find a mission to dedicate themselves to.
But it doesn't happen with here's your pill, take it, everything's going to be okay. It's not working. So it's really more about putting lots of tools in the toolbox and finding what you gravitate toward that really does help you feel better.
Another one of those projects is a video series started by Marine Bomb Squad technician Joe Diamond of Mullica Hill, New Jersey. When Diamond first returned from a tour in Iraq, he divorced his then wife, started drinking, and briefly lived out of his truck until a friend took him in.
When I moved in with him, I started talking about things. I started having discussions and you know, not feeling judged and kind of opening the bottle up. And almost immediately after, I started feeling better, because once I started talking about it, I could actually start analyzing the feelings I'm having.
So Diamond started a video project he called The Stain of War, in which he interviews other vets with combat PTSD. He hopes they'll share their stories and coping mechanisms, and he also hopes the stigma around PTSD will erode if the public can better understand it.
And, you know, I know that coping with it is tough. Trust me, I've coped with it, and, you know, there's millions of us out there that have coped with it.
That's Brian Fisher of Upper Darby, one of Diamond's first interview subjects in the Stain of War series. Fisher, who participated in the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, says talking in the video helped him open up to friends and family.
It was actually very easy for me, because it was like me and Joe just shooting the breeze and talking about what happened, and you know, wasn't like just somebody, no offense, just asking me, you know, questions. It was one Marine that had been there to another Marine.
And Fisher hopes more projects like The Stain of War and The Weekly Fight will make it easier for vets struggling back home and civilians who never left to understand each other.
We've come so far as a country in the past 20, 30 years as far as veterans dealing with PTSD that, you know, in the next 20 years, I can only imagine that it'll be, you know, there won't be that bridge. It'll be all connected.
For WHYY, I'm Joe Hernandez.
Sunday marks the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Let's consider the impact of this event on Americans now with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, how do we measure the extent to which Americans are concerned about terrorism?
That's a very interesting question. We do know, and I just looked, we had conducted a poll on September 7 through 10, 2001, just before 2011. The terrorist attacks, of course, on September 11th in that year, and we found zero mentions of terrorism. That changed dramatically. In polls thereafter, we had almost half of Americans who said the most important problem facing the country was terrorism. That is in the fall of 2001. But that began to go down and down and down. And then over the years since, we've had down again 1%, 0% mentioning terrorism in many years since then. You do have blips. Last December, we had 16% who said terrorism was our top problem. We were interviewing after the attacks in San Bernardino and in Paris. But then it's fallen back down again.
And as such, is blip the best descriptive of how folks react in the moment and then it quickly recedes from memory?
That's what it looks like so far. It's kind of a latent consideration in the minds of the average American out there, terrorism. But when we say what's the big problem facing the country, it's the economy, dysfunctional government, and a lot of other things before they mention terrorism.
And so now 2 months out from the election, what is the correlation between how satisfied Americans are with the way things are going and what might happen on November 8th?
Yeah, that's a great question, because one of Donald Trump's motifs, his campaign themes, of course, is to say things are terrible. He says, I'm going to make America great again. You may have noticed he says that repetitively. And that implies, of course, that America is not great right now. And in fact, only 27% of Americans say they are satisfied with the way things are going in the U.S. right now. But in answer to your question, we've looked back at previous elections, and that really doesn't correlate with turnover and who controls the White House. One prime example is 2000, when 63%, that's a very high number of Americans, said they were satisfied with the way things were going. That was the end of the dot-com boom. Bill Clinton was president. And, of course, he wasn't running for re-election, but it was Al Gore, his vice president, running against George W. Bush. And, of course, Gore won the popular vote. George Bush was elected president. So that high satisfaction didn't keep the White House from being turned over at that point from Democratic control to Republican control. And in 2012, satisfaction was about where it is now, 25%. And, of course, the White House stayed in Democratic control. So this overall measure of whether Americans think things are going well or not doesn't necessarily predict, the bottom line is, to a turnover in control of the White House.
Now let's go back to what you just said. You may have noticed, and yes, make America great again. Do Americans tend to notice what Donald Trump says more than what Hillary Clinton says?
They are. We're in the middle of a very fascinating project now, which involves asking Americans every day, did you read, see, or hear something about Trump or about Clinton last night? And then if so, what is it? And we're analyzing the data. But one thing we can tell you is that after the conventions, that would be through August and in the first part of September, Trump dominates Americans' consciousness more than Hillary Clinton. In other words, Americans are more likely to say, yes, I heard something about Trump yesterday, than to say, yes, I heard something about Clinton yesterday. What's interesting is what people recall having heard about Trump, Dave, reacts to kind of what was in the news. If he goes to Mexico, the next day Americans say, what I heard about Trump yesterday is he went to Mexico. But what people recall having heard, seen, or read about Hillary Clinton is much less related to what she's doing and tends to be dominated by emails. Emails and emails. It's a very, very dominant motif in what Americans say they read, heard, or saw about her, and that is the problems with emails, even though that was 4 years ago when she was Secretary of State. So I can't emphasize enough across a lot of our data how much that sticks to, so to speak, Hillary Clinton in the minds of the average American.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. This year's Fringe Festival is peppered with experimental dance events. Some are in studios, others are in enormous spaces like Drexel's Armory in West Philly. One work by celebrated choreographer Boris Sharmatz combines intellectual concepts and intense physicality. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna reports it invites audiences to sweat right along with the performers.
Imagine a group of 24 dancers moving almost frantically on stage for very short intervals. some of their movements vibrating with one another as each dancer starts the journey from a different seat in the middle of the audience. That's the interaction French choreographer Boris Charmatz creates with his dance La Levée des Conflits, the elevation of conflicts.
Piece Levée des Conflits is a very strange piece. It really came from an idea that we, a big group of dancers, would be moving, but what would be created would be almost a static object, like a sculpture, a moving sculpture.
Charmatz is more than a choreographer. He's a dance force in Europe. He's part of a deliberate effort by the French government to create experimental choreographic centers across the country, says Nick Stuccio, director of the Fringe Arts Festival and a former dancer.
It's a federally funded system of 19 choreographic centers. Imagine that, around the country of France. Each center has an artist as artistic director. They're given four-year posts. And they are allowed to experiment and to research their craft. And the result has been an enormous impact globally.
A lot of difficulty because you relax to go down, but as soon as you relax the knees, but this is...
As part of his Philadelphia performance and residency, Charmatz led a workshop and rehearsal with 24 of Philadelphia's top dancers. They were preparing for a public performance outside the art museum. It's not an easy rehearsal, and it takes some artistic guts to try on Charmatz's dance style.
My idea of choreography is that it should be a frame for collisions. Instead of thinking choreography as a clear, clean frame design, I think it's to set up a situation with some clear lines, some design of it. But chaos, accidents, experience, even improvisation is part of the choreography.
In his search for displacement and controlled collisions, he once created a dance where the performers put pants on their heads.
And then with your right eye, you see a little bit on the left, and with your left eye, you see a little bit on the right, but you don't see in front. It's awful if you want to just perform and see each other. So you're alone, you hear your breath, you don't know where you go, and the dancers, they bump into each other sometimes. We are like phantoms, and we hear the others a little bit. And I love that, I must say. Choreography that is not just clarity, but also chaotic way to think.
Makes sense, says Stuccio, because Charmatz, like other contemporary choreographers, see dance as a part of the fabric of our everyday, somewhat chaotic lives. Charmatz's Levée des Conflits runs tonight and tomorrow night at the Drexel University Armory. Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
Finally this evening, for Eagles fans looking forward to Sunday's home opener, the focus will be on the players, the coaches, and the game. But what they might not realize is there is a year-long, behind-the-scenes effort to keep the organization running. And that includes a kitchen staff tasked with preparing breakfast, lunch, even dinner for everyone from the ground crew to the owner to even the voice of the Eagles, Merrill Reese.
I get a chicken burger. Sometimes I get a turkey burger. Sometimes I get a shake. Something very, very healthy and something light. This is my 40th season, so I'll get the hang of things after a while.
Head to newsworks.org for a behind-the-scenes video of the kitchen crew that keeps the Bird Gang going. That's all for Newsworks Tonight. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the controls this week, Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Adam Stanishevsky. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.